Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Anyway, thank you for coming to this session. It seems we have quite a few people today. My name is Tim Dawes. I'm the Executive Director of the Canadian Federation of Business School Deans. My colleagues, we have Erlich Hommel from EFMD, who is also a professor at, where are you a professor now? Bristol. Professor of Finance at EBS. Michael Powell was the chair of the Australian Business School Dean's Council and the vice chancellor at Griffith University, and Dan LeClaire from ASSB, who was the vice president of ASSB. The way we thought we'd conduct the session a little bit today, since a lot of what we were planning to cover was sort of dealt with to a large extent this morning, so we'll try to give our take on what we see it from other parts of the world and maybe open it up to more of a discussion, because I'm guessing a lot of people are here because they're interested in learning about, you know, what's going on in the UK and what's going on in our part of the world and what's different and what's the same and how that can help you in connecting with us. So what we thought we would do would be three quick presentations, 5-10 minutes each of each person, to cover different aspects of the question that we were asked to raise. And then it opened up for not a question and answer, but a discussion. Tell us what you want to know about the parts of the world that we represent and how you think it would impact you. Does that sound like a good way to proceed? Okay, do you want to start?
Well, in the program, I'm listed as professor of finance at EBS rather than EFMD, which gives me a bit more freedom to be critical and to think a bit out of the box, and hopefully that this will encourage a subsequent discussion. If you look at the business school literature, the literature on business schools, it's quite remarkable. Ken knows that quite well, obviously, is that, you know, we seem to be very good in critiquing ourselves, we're not so good in actually coming up with solutions that actually then help us to overcome the problems that we're facing as a sector. And I thought it was interesting as a German that there was a lot of reference made to Germany this morning. And I was actually almost tempted to ask, well, why doesn't Germany have a vibrant business school sector then? Or what does that mean, that a country that is so successful economically apparently doesn't need business schools to educate the management elite? Now, overall, we obviously know that the market for management education is a huge growth story. Yeah? And especially UK business schools are benefiting from this significantly. The question is only, are we actually a frog that is sitting in the water that is slowly heated up? So is there actually a change looking around the corner that we have to deal with, that we should prepare ourselves for? And obviously, a lot of the things that we have also prepared, you know, have been mentioned this morning. So from my perspective, certainly one big question is the financial viability of the research-based business model of business schools. Is that really something that we can fund in the future? That, in the light of the change of educational delivery with the spread of technology-enhanced education, and in line with that, also changing demand patterns, that students actually are expecting education in different forms. In that context, for instance, is it really necessary to deliver education in the form of a degree? Or will degrees be assembled in different forms down the road? You know, that's something that we could reflect on. I think from my perspective, that will lead to changes in the institutional ecology, for instance, via competitive entry. The shifting of institutional boundaries. I think what we're seeing these days is the beginning of an unbundling of business schools, where a lot of the things that actually are now comprised within the boundaries of a traditional business schools, a traditional business school may actually then be combined on an arm's length basis down the road. You know, at least that's something that is potentially feasible. And in that context, I think from an EFMD perspective, our accreditation systems are built on the principle of diversity. Well, what does that actually mean for the future? What is diversity? Very often when you talk to people in the sector, you have the feeling diversity is like, well, world-class research and vocational research. Well, I think that's not it. I think we have to look for different forms of diversity where the different types of activities are nevertheless excellent in, you know, whatever market they operate, whatever stakeholder group that it actually targets. And so overall, the question, I think, and from my perspective, is what is actually our institutional purpose? And in that context, what is actually the role of impact? Yeah? And obviously, the key word here is the stakeholder-oriented business school. Yeah? And it doesn't mean necessarily that we give up our mission as an educational institution, but that maybe we have a clearer concept of why we exist and where we actually make a contribution. And in that context also, how we actually want to measure our own performance. Even like institutional performance of business schools, what is it? I think we can have a long discussion on that, and we will probably not arrive at a clear answer. At least the literature hasn't provided a clear answer on that. And I don't know whether I'm already out of time. Okay. Now, when it comes to the growing role of impact, why haven't we seen it so far? I think there are two factors. First of all, there's a lack of a clearly defined institutional objective. And in my view, it's not the ranking position. It must be deeper than that. And the second aspect is the atomized production model. Okay, everything is an individual activity. You know, we assign a course to a faculty, go off and teach the course. We expect from faculty members to deliver articles, typically with researchers from other institutions. So I think there's an institutional coherence that we need to develop to actually also systematically deliver on impact. So that will probably then trigger the emergence, if we actually go down that road, that will trigger the emergence of new organizational models that will require a more team-based approach. And I have to say, as I said at the very beginning, we're good in critiquing ourselves, not very good in solving these issues. I think the biggest force that will implement change is the market. I'm a strong believer in individual rationality. If something is not individually rational from the business school's point of view, in my view, it will not happen. And a lot of the arguments that we're hearing about being more impactful, more social, there is always an embedded prisoner's dilemma situation. And so why should we actually collectively do something that is individually not rational? And obviously there's a danger associated with that, you know, because it would argue that, you know, education can be monetized. And I feel just as uneasy about this as presumably all of you. But there is this question that there's that market prices will eventually force behavior by triggering strategic and behavioral changes in business schools. So our challenge, I think, is collectively how we can actually influence that process. Can it actually be influenced? And then maybe in closing, before I pass it on to one of my colleagues here, is, you know, it's also the question from the perspective of accreditation organizations. We can obviously very narrowly think about how to include impact in standards and criteria. Yeah? That's obvious. That's simple. EFMD has also introduced a system, BSIS, that actually allows business schools to get a better idea about their impact in society in a very broad way. That's an offering that we're making to business schools, in particular our members. But even beyond that, I think the question is, you know, what is the scope of accreditors to actually shape sectoral developments? So if we actually believe that the ecology in management education will become more diverse, to what extent should accreditors actually invite that change? Because very often we have very restrictive criteria, you know, what types of business schools can actually apply for accreditation in terms of size, in terms of breadth, etc. Actually, we could also ask the question, what is the future of institutional accreditation? If we believe that business schools will be unbundled in some form, does that mean that accreditation has to be unbundled as well? That we actually start to accredit particular activities of business schools or of, you know, organizations that are involved in some way in the delivery of management education? And I know that AACSB is thinking along these lines a bit. And maybe we also need a broader concept of excellence in the context also of clarifying our view what actually institutional performance is. So hopefully I've thrown out enough food for thought, and I'll then later on also expecting your questions on that. Thank you.
If I may just throw something out before, you were talking about in Germany how the business school sector is somewhat less developed than other countries in Europe. I was at a conference this last week with the conference board. We're doing some work with them on management education. And from the survey that they did recently, they found that most companies are hiring business from the social sciences and not the business schools. We're actually second in Canada in terms of where they're getting their graduates, and for that matter, where they want their graduates from. Just an interesting reflection.
Okay, thank you, Tim. I'm Michael Powell. I'm Pro-Vice Chancellor of Business at Griffith University. In Australia, most of the business schools are integrated with the university sector, so we're a bit like in the UK here. We don't have many or any, I don't think, independent business schools other than a couple of private providers that have come into the market. I want to talk a little bit about some of the changes that are happening in the Australian system right now. Maybe you're looking for a job in Australia. There you go. Talk to me later. Tell you about some of the trends there, which are similar or not similar to what's happening here. Some of them seem to be quite similar, given what I've been hearing today in the session so far. Some of the things that are happening now here in Australia, I think maybe in the UK you've had some experience with them already, and we can learn from that. One of the things we haven't talked about a lot is government regulation today, or government deregulation, if you like, of the sector. And that's something that's happening in Australia right now. We have a Conservative government elected a year or so ago, high on its agenda is to free up the market forces to take effect in the higher education sector. And it has a bunch of legislative changes right now in the Parliament, which are very similar to what David Cameron did here a couple of years back, perhaps going a little further. So, for instance, deregulating fees so that universities can set their own fees and there's no fee cap. So there's no £9,000 cap. You can take them as high as you like. It's the market decides whether they want to pay that amount. So deregulating the fees. Now, you might think, well, that's kind of makes it easier for schools or for universities to decide where to go, but really haven't been in the middle of it. It doesn't, because there's a lot of uncertainty out there and everybody's watching everybody else to see where they will move. You don't want to be the first mover in this fee-setting exercise. You want to see what your competitors are doing and so forth. At the same time, the competition authority is keeping an eye on what universities do, and you're not allowed to talk to each other and discuss your fees, because that would be constraint of trade. So there's a lot of anxiety in the system right now about where are you going to place yourself. If you're GO8, we call it, which is a bit like your Russell Group, but perhaps even smaller and a bit more exclusive, you know, you might be able to set your fees at what the market will take. If you're in the middle of the pack, a bit like my university, then perhaps you can't go quite so high. There's a little uncertainty about price sensitivity. We are a little bit reassured by what happened here in the UK when you lifted or loosened your fee limits up to £9,000. Most schools went up to that limit, and the market seemed to accept that. So new government, deregulation of the system, more uncertainty, more opportunity perhaps for universities and business schools to differentiate. And I guess that would be the second thing I'd say. Why is the government doing this? It wants to see market forces at work. Secondly, it thinks that we're all the same. We all try to be the same, and we all try to do research, we try to do teaching and so forth. And it would like to see more differentiation in the supplier end of higher education. And I think it believes that leaving the market to push change will result in some schools differentiating themselves around a high-quality teaching product and others become more research-focused and so on. Well, we don't know that that will occur, but we are starting to see a lot more differentiation occurring within universities and within business schools. So many business schools are moving now to differentiating their faculty or their staffing composition, and partly in a result of these market forces, partly because business schools, like other parts of the university, but particularly business schools, are subject to competing objectives. On the one hand, the university wants us all to be great researchers, and I, as the kind of dean equivalent, get measured on that. What's our research output each year? I have targets. What's research income, grant income? What's our student satisfaction ratio, student experience, graduate outcomes? All those measurements are out there, and we get measured on them. But they are different in competing. Can we be a real strong research powerhouse at the same time as having a wonderful student experience and having that demonstrated in the metrics that measure student experience? And some of us are saying, well, that's hard. Our best researchers don't want to be teaching much. They want to focus on their research. So how do you do both? Well, what's happening, and this is a trend that's occurring in Australia, is that there is more specialisation of roles. So we're seeing more research-only or research-focused positions, we call them, where people come and are hired to do research and to publish. And they're measured, their success is measured by that research output or the research income they earn or whatever. And on the other hand, we're hiring more teaching-only or teaching-focused faculty or staff. Now, and so, like, for instance, in my school, we're looking at a target of around 20% pedagogical instructors focused around teaching, with a requirement for scholarship, not so much original research, but scholarship. And how you measure scholarship, how you define scholarship, how do you know when somebody's undertaking scholarship that would meet their employment conditions is a good question, and one we're still working through, I think. We believe, in many Australian schools, fits some of the new flexibilities in the AACSB, for instance, definitions around staff capability and staff qualifications or faculty qualifications. It also perhaps enables us to meet these somewhat competing objectives. So most schools are going down that path, not all, but most. And then there are some schools that are focusing really on the learning experience itself, and they're making that their... they're not too worried about whether they get an international accreditation or not, but they want to attract students and they want to do well on the teaching and learning side, and that can be demonstrated in, with other types of measurement. So deregulation of the market, part of the objective is to free up the university system, which is seen as being too closed, too traditional, too defined by doing the same thing we've done for 100 years. So I think that's one of the changes that's occurring. Another is innovation in the learning and teaching side itself, where trying to move away from the lecture plus tutorial model. The lecture plus tutorial model has been around for 30 or 40 years. It used to be lectures governed by overhead transparencies. They got changed to PowerPoint slides. And so we now, you know, death by PowerPoint in the lecture. Trying to move that around. There's been a big move towards what we call flipped classrooms, which you might have here in the UK as well, where, and this goes back to the comment I'm going to make, goes back to, I think, what Rod was saying in the previous session around content. Rather than lectures and universities being about delivering content, content will be made available in a blended type of model. So content is there, is provided, it'll be there online for you to review and so on, but your classroom experience will be around problem solving, around problems, around dealing with questions or issues that are raised by the content, or case studies that demonstrate how people have used this content in the past. So there is a move to implement a kind of a more blended model of pedagogy where the lecture is just part of it and what we call workshops. This year at Griffith Business School, I've banned the term tutorial. We're not using that term anymore. The next step will be banning the term lecture. And the tutorial is now a workshop, or it's a seminar, or it's a problem-solving something. And that's what it is. So we get away from the model of, you know, 2 hours in front of a class lecturing them using PowerPoint slides and a tutorial where somebody walks in and says, have we got any questions? And the kids look at you and say, no, God, I haven't got any questions, you know. And then they give you another lecture in the tutorial, and that's the learning process or so-called learning process. So I think a big move towards blended delivery. The other change that's occurring in the Australian system, and here too, I'm sure, is the introduction of online delivery models. And, of course, that's been in the US for some time with some specialised universities like Phoenix and others doing that. But that's also a trend that's emerging in Australia. It's been, you know, it's not just doing MOOCs, it's doing the whole thing, the online delivery, online assessment, et cetera. And, of course, it's a worldwide movement. But I think we're seeing a little more purposeful, if I have to use the term, move in that direction in Australian business schools. And I think we're still learning on that, so there's still a lot of learning to come from that experience of online delivery and how we do the things that were also talked about earlier about not just content delivery online, but skill development online. You know, some would argue, and I've had these discussions with my colleagues, that if you talk about teamwork or talk about leadership skills, how do you learn those? How do you develop those through the online medium or the online pedagogy? Don't you have to have face-to-face contact to do that or not? And so there's some interesting discussions around whether that online medium will allow you to develop the skills that I think Rod Bristow talked about earlier. The final trend or the final issue that I just wanted to lay before you is that, and I think this is referred to earlier, not with regards to the Australian experience, but our industry Minister for Industry, Ian McFarlane, appeared before a group of our Deputy Vice Chancellor's research and fired a shot across their bows by saying that most of the universities are irrelevant to the innovation agenda in Australia, and that we have a very low rate of engagement between industry and universities and research and development. Australia actually has a very low spend on R&D anyway, but much of what goes on in universities doesn't appear relevant to industry, and there's not much connectedness. And so, you know, that comment that maybe universities will become irrelevant was sort of the direction he was heading. And he said, well, if you're not going to do it, if you're not going to make this thing work, if you're not going to make the innovation, everybody wants to be an innovation economy now, if you're not going to sort of show us how universities and business schools contribute to that innovation agenda, then maybe we'll have to force you to by measuring it in some way. And he indicated that the government would be looking at developing metrics around university industry engagement and in part just collaboration and engagement, and then moving on from that into impact, of course. And I don't think he'd want to read 7,000 case studies about impact. He would want to see some metrics that would demonstrate impact is taking place. Now, that's a very complex ask to develop metrics around that, but that's certainly the direction he was heading. So three things: deregulating, the role of markets becoming more important, allowing private entrance into that delivery system. So the government has indicated also that it will fund university places in private providers, for-profit private providers, so the universities won't have a monopoly over that government funding, and increased differentiation on the delivery side, on the supplier side, which has a reflection inside the universities, inside the business schools as well, in these different emerging roles. And then finally, around industry engagement, which the government is now seeing as being a really important part of its agenda. Since we spend billions of dollars on universities, we've got to get them to talk to industry.
Thank you, Tim. Just maybe I'll just continue to pick up a point from each discussion. In Canada, we have the funding pressures, but we don't have the privatization issues because there are 10 jurisdictions and they couldn't ever agree on anything anyway, so we're not at that point. But in terms of the research issue, it's very interesting. Canada has one of the highest R&D per capita budgets across the university. But in terms of productivity, we're right at the bottom of the bucket. So Canadian university, and this whole relevant applied research is an issue that Canada's been struggling with for years, and it's becoming more important. Because on the one hand, the universities produce very good research, which all gets taken across the border to the south and turned into commercialization. And it's a bit of the other side of the same coin. You know, you're probably better at innovating than we are. We can do research, but we can't sell it. And that's a good lead into our American colleague, who are very good at selling this sort of stuff.
So I get to talk about the American perspective, which I will try very hard not to do, I suppose. But I'm Dan LeClaire. I'm from AACSB International, and I hope many of you know about us. We're best known for accrediting business schools, but that's not all. But let me just first say I'm happy to be up here with my colleagues from around the world, and especially happy to be at my first ABS meeting. So I've been with the AACSB for 15 years, and this is my first one, and I really appreciate the opportunity. And I've learned a lot already, and I also appreciate that we've begun to work with ABS in a variety of ways. I sat on this innovation task force that was talked about this morning. We're doing a bridge program. If you haven't learned about this, it's going to be hosted at CAS and co-sponsored by ABS. And we're anxious to make this work in this environment. So we're happy to be here at this meeting, and it's a pleasure to work with ABS. So, you know, I was busy scribbling notes all morning and even during our session, so I have the benefit of speaking tomorrow. So one of the things I want to do is not say too much about what I'm going to talk about tomorrow, and I'm already developing a sense of what might be interesting to you. But also, I'd like to, you know, try to go a few places where we haven't gone already today in my remarks. And the good news about this is that it gives me the opportunity to talk about some things I don't usually get to talk about. Most of my work at AACSB is really deeply engaging business schools and talking about the issues and challenges. We've written a lot. We've written about impact and about innovation and globalization. And we continue to explore these. But I'm going to go a few places that perhaps we haven't gone today or haven't gone deeply enough, I think, just to stimulate thinking. Doesn't mean we have to explore these further. You could ask me anything about AACSB, but I'm gonna give it a shot. So one of the things I do besides AACSB is I work in economic development. I'm on the board of the Tampa Hillsborough Economic Development Corporation, and one of the areas we're working on is healthcare. So I've begun to learn quite a bit about what's happening in healthcare, especially in the U.S. environment. And one of the big things that's happening in healthcare in the U.S., it's early stages, but we're calling it the patient-to-consumer revolution. The patient-to-consumer revolution. And I think we can learn a lot from what's happening there about what's happening in higher education and in business education. But it's not perhaps exactly what you expect. In fact, today we talked a little bit about the increasing demands as a consequence of that consumerism. But I think it's actually a bit further, and I think we're underestimating the change that would occur because of this shift in thinking. And I want to just talk about a couple of ideas. One is, in healthcare, they're talking a lot about the quantified self. Right? So you've heard of Fitbits, for example. And the idea is that we have a much better understanding of our own characteristics, our own health, right? We monitor, we document, we create big data, and that big data is then used in a way that helps us to maintain our health more effectively, right? So one of the things happening in higher education is there's a lot of work to try to arm students, consumers, with better information about their educational prospects and educational opportunities. And they're doing it, these companies are doing it in a way that connects more strongly with business, with employers. So there's a company out there, if you haven't explored them, called Degreed, for example. And one of the things they're doing is they're trying to compare, allow data, or collect data in such a way so as to make degrees and other forms of education more comparable and useful to businesses, right? Another thing that this suggests is that in the healthcare industry, they're pretty sure that the healthcare industry will actually get bigger as a consequence of this movement, not smaller, right? In fact, in the U.S. at least, healthcare has become really about fixing problems and not about maintaining health. So the big growing industry is this growing industry about how to help consumers take care of themselves with better information and with better tools, right? And I think this is something that's happening in higher education. So the point is, in this particular discussion, is I think that one of the things that we need to pay more attention is to the changing ecosystem surrounding higher education. Not simply what we do and how to do it better, but how the environment and the ecosystem in which we operate is changing around us that will either make us more relevant or less. So that's one thing. A second thing is a series of conversations we're having at AACSB with employers. Right? We, for the longest time, nearly 100 years, didn't really talk much to employers, and we're starting to do this much more. You know, obviously, one of the questions relates to the expectations about skills and about knowledge. But the kinds of conversations we're starting to have relate to how they're changing the way they source talent and develop talent, especially in light of the alternatives available to them. Right? So in just recent months, I've had conversations with people at Deloitte, people at Microsoft, people at even places like GE. And they're all telling me the same thing, that it's changing dramatically how they source talent. And, for example, I just got off the phone with a person from one of those organizations. I won't tell you which one. And she said, for the first time in her work, she didn't visit a campus to recruit. Right? For the first time in her exposure to this. And she said, what we're doing is we're actually trying to reach beyond the schools we normally recruit to, and we're trying to reach a broader range of talent at other schools. And what that means is we can only do so many visits. I talked to a person at another one of those organizations about a recent gift a business school had received to build a new $8 million career services center. And the response was, why would they do that? Right? Why would they do that? We're not using career services centers anymore to reach students. In fact, those students are actually much more likely to contact us directly today than ever before, right? Not through the university or not through the business schools. So we can go on with this discussion, but it's not just the skills. It's not only the expectations about content, but it's the processes that businesses are using and how those are impacting the way we think about our education. And it's being facilitated by, again, companies as part of our ecosystem. LinkedIn, whether we realize it or not, is now part of our ecosystem, right? They not only rank universities, right, but obviously they present a pretty big opportunity for your students to connect directly with business and to develop their own networks, which many business schools argue are their primary benefit, right? So again, the changing ecosystem. And then thirdly, something I perhaps even know less about, I'm honestly walking on territory that's actually new to me as well as perhaps many of you, is the research ecosystem. We talk a lot about research impact, and we talk about it in ways that suggest that the trick is to get faculty to think differently about why they're doing the work. We talk about the trick being, you know, perhaps to translate our research in a way that makes a difference or is readable, right? But one of the things that's happening as we speak is that the ecosystem that surrounds academic research is being disrupted, just like higher education, just like many other industries. And we're moving from really a strict focus on pre-publication to review to more post-publication review. We're bypassing traditional channels, traditional academic journals, in favor of doing things like academic blogging and sharing ideas. It's happening at a very small scale, but again, there are companies emerging that help to support an ecosystem that's shifting the way we think about research and the impact that we create. It's just a very small example. There's a lot more research in higher education than ever before. What we're getting at AACSB, and I've been getting it for 10-plus years, is a lot of faculty members say, look, I want my research to be impactful. I don't need to worry about tenure anymore. I don't really need another academic journal publication. I wrote this piece to actually help the industry. Could you disseminate this research article to your membership? 1,400 business schools worldwide, right? 40,000 plus in our database. So many faculty members are looking for alternative channels to make their research more impactful, right? So all of this is changing the way we think about our ecosystems and research. So if there's one thing that I hope we take out of this is really not to underestimate the extent of change that could be caused by alternative companies, not just competitive, not just new competitors, but the opportunities that are created by intermediaries. In fact, in many industries, when disruption happens, when the industries change, it's not necessarily just because alternative providers pop up, but it's because of the intermediaries and the other types of organizations that emerge in our ecosystem that we didn't really take advantage of. And if I could just emphasize that as something we haven't talked enough about today, but as a big opportunity for business schools, I'd like to put that out there. Tomorrow, you know, just to give you a preview of some things that I didn't want to hit on today, the aim is to talk a little bit about these questions about innovation, about engagement with practice, and especially this notion of impact, and how it's changing the way we think about quality and the way we benchmark against themselves, even the way it might be changing accreditations in this market.
It's interesting you were talking about the skill set what employers are looking for, and to reinforce what Dan said, some discussions I've had with employers and people who do research is that they're looking less and less for the skill sets of graduates as more graduates that they will train themselves. You know, they more and more see universities, business schools, and other faculties as producing trainable people that they can then use to adapt to their environment, which is evolving anyway. I'm going to stand up because I'm sorry, I can't see you very well with the lights here. Maybe we could just throw us... there's lots of things we could have covered. I think there's lots of things we can cover, but it would be good to know what you want to know about our environments as well, what's relevant to your environment, because I see a lot of similarities between the UK and Australia, between the States and Canada, and I think there's a lot of things where that are different and a lot of the same. So maybe if I could just start throwing out for some questions, and what do you want to know, what do you want to hear from us about our environments? In the back there.
Hi there. My name's Brian Kriefman. I'm from Regent's University in London. It's quite a new university. We're a not-for-profit. I've been listening today to all the speakers, and a theme that's coming over to me is a kind of switch of focus from a traditional business school teaching rather than helping students learn, switching from teaching to of functional areas of management, such as finance or economics or organizational behavior and so on, and switching to helping give students the skills they need to be successful employees or innovators in their own right. Professor Powell mentioned moving away from the lecture scenario and the tutorial scenarios and giving students more of an opportunity for problem solving rather than sitting down and listening to the academic tell them how it is. And one of the skills I think that people have been talking about, not just here but in other fora, was about leadership. Leadership and innovation. Leadership is a very difficult thing to teach, I think. I've never tried to teach it, but I'm not sure what your views are. How can you teach leadership? And how can you teach or give students the chance to learn about being entrepreneurial and innovative and creative was another word that has come through today. So leadership, innovation, creativity, entrepreneurship. If I can, just a little quick anecdote of a graduate that I met who graduated from Regent's about 3 years ago, and I met him socially recently. And I asked him, I said, so he did his first degree in business and then went into the world of work. And I asked him, I said, well, how much of your degree, what parts of your degree, your business degree, did you find most useful? And he said, none of it. None of it. So I said, so what are you doing? And he says, well, I'm shipping steel from scrap metal merchants in one part of the world and moving them to another part of the world where other people want it. And this guy, this student, to me was the epitome of an entrepreneur. And we didn't teach him to do that. He just got up and did it. And I'd love to know, you know, is there a kind of institutional business school way of making more of him? Thank you.
Well, that's a tough one.
Yeah, I'll just start off and just leave, because it brings to mind two of my alumni. One did a bachelor's degree major in marketing. But when he was at, he tells us that when he was at university in the business school, he did very little academic work. In fact, he scraped through, and he worked part-time at part-time jobs. And he finally put together $5,000, started his own business. And he now owns and operates a $60 million coffee business in the city. And so he's a very proud alumnus, and we're very keen to have him involved with us for obvious reasons, hoping he may want to give back at some point. But anyway, he didn't learn much from us. He says the thing that he learned most was around marketing, but it was mostly his own and drive and energy and his upbringing. His parents were sort of small business people and so on, and that drove him. But he did. He was very pleased, mindful of the lessons he'd learned in marketing, but very minimal. The other alumnus also went out and started a business, and he indicated to me that, yes, he had learned a lot, and he'd been able to put in practice some of the learnings he'd had from case studies around strategy and around business startups and so on. So there was two different answers to that question. Both were entrepreneurs, if you like. One very much self-driven and didn't think university added that much value, to be honest. The other sort of felt it did. But with your question about leadership and creativity and so on, can they be taught? A lot, there's a big debate around those issues, you know, but most academics and business schools believe that you can teach and encourage and enhance those capabilities. Leadership, not so much about teaching, but great leadership theory, though people who teach it do, but perhaps around the ability to understand yourself. For self, you can't be a good leader then unless you know yourself. So self-awareness and then some of the skills that leaders have. Communication is one of the key skills that leaders need to have. And some people have that naturally, others don't so much. And so maybe there's some of those skills that are required by leaders that you can inculcate or help people learn. Creativity. I was at a business school in Australia last week at UTS in Sydney, and they now have created a new bachelor's degree around creative enterprise, I think it is, or whereby students, and it's a double degree, it's a four-year degree, students stay in their original discipline, it might be in the arts in some area, and then they have business interface with it, engage with it. They've been just inundated with students who want to do this. They thought they'd get 30 students or 40 students. They tell me that they had 5,000 student inquiries for this particular degree. So our degrees, like in the UK, are three-year undergraduate degrees. This is a four-year one. And the idea is that they do their main discipline area. It might be biology or it might be something else. But alongside that, they do some creativity, and it's a bachelor in creative something, creative thinking or creative enterprise. So maybe you can get those things to work by providing people the opportunity to exercise and develop their innovative capability.
Good. Just maybe to add to what Michael says, it's not only about the content and the skills, but what I see happening a lot is business schools really working hard on the engagement and the way we the environments that we create for creativity to happen. Let me give you just an example. In Beijing, there's a couple of schools. There's Tsinghua University and there's Peking University, Tsinghua being more science and Peking being more liberal arts. And in the backyard of Tsinghua, which also happens to be the backyard of Peking, there's a district where there's a lot of new business creation, a lot of innovation happening, and not a lot of creativity. And really just creating a strength and engaging that environment or creating that environment to nurture that creativity is becoming pretty important. Some of that means creating opportunities for different perspectives to collide and intersect. And as a consequence, I think we're stimulating a lot more creativity. So the point is, it's not just the content and the skills and what you teach, but it's the environment that you're creating and the engagements that you're encouraging that really matter in your schools. For this question.
Yeah, and I think from a Canadian perspective as well, you see more and more schools have much more international engagement, and also some schools are moving back to more general liberal arts and other courses. I think schools are starting to realize that you can't teach creativity. You've got to put people in positions where they have to figure it out for themselves. And sometimes the way you do that with young people is to throw them in a situation that they don't understand naturally. I think there's a question up here.
Thank you. My name is Beth Rogers from Portsmouth Business School. My specialism is sales as a practitioner and as an academic. And I'd be interested to know to what degree in your countries you feel that business schools are their own best reference account for some of the things like commercialization, which was mentioned in the context of Canada. You know, it would just be great for my students to get their hands on products coming or ideas coming out of science and presenting them, using them as case studies. And I thought, well, how does it happen? Have you come across business schools reaching out to science reaching out to the business school? Because very often within universities, I think that the skills that are in the business school are often put in a silo. And that connection that we want to make in order to facilitate commercialization is very difficult to do.
The engineers think they can do it, and the business people think they can do it. A few years ago, we brought a bunch of business school deans together with a bunch of engineering deans for a day-long discussion. And they couldn't discuss anything because they didn't understand each other. And I think the culture of innovation in business school, at least in Canada, is not there yet. They're struggling to find ways of doing it. But I don't think it's there yet. I don't know about...
Maybe just a couple of comments that might be helpful. By the way, I thought where you're going to go with that question is sales, because it's one of the things I'm learning in my conversations with some folks in the HR space, that they're really looking for schools that excel in this sales area. But with the science and management, what I've seen is there's not just a single approach. What I've noticed is that the old approach to bring engineers into MBA programs is not the one that seems to be working that well. Part of it, I think, is because many in the science area are afraid things are happening too quickly, that they're going to lose their edge when they go back to school or when they otherwise engage in management. But I've seen examples where business schools will take PhDs and try to give them the business basics. I've seen instances where we take undergraduates coming out of STEM fields and try to give them sort of a crash course in business. I've seen a lot more business schools. When we started some research on innovation, the impact of business schools on innovation in their communities, we noticed that business school involvement with incubators and accelerators was more often the exception than the rule, and we're seeing much more of that type of engagement, so that the accelerator or the incubator becomes the venue by which science and management and leadership work together. So there's not, I think, one set model for how business schools and engineering schools or even some of the basic sciences are working together. But it's happening more and more, that's for sure.
I fully agree. I think the challenge for universities is to create these platforms, and let me use Dan's term here, of engagement in a very broad sense. We come from this tradition in management education that we believe that education can be planned in some form. Yeah? And so this whole philosophy of learning outcomes, of measuring the attainment of learning outcomes, doesn't really fit to these topics. When we're talking about innovation, leadership, actually also ethics, you know, that falls more into the category of practical wisdom. And that is something where I think, you know, with just by creating structures, you cannot ensure that this will actually lead to a successful environment and a successful outcomes. So it's platforms, and then you have to allow for a certain, you know, kind of ad hoc engagement of the people that you actually bring together. And, you know, in a way, this refers to a bigger topic that we're also facing in the business school sector, where, you know, some people in our market are saying, you know, customization is the future. You really have to look at the student's capabilities, and help the student to excel given his or her capabilities and also preferences and dreams. And on the other hand, we have also business schools that are following explicitly an industrial production model, where they're actually very much focused on managing an institution on a structural level and basically channeling students through a homogeneous process without actually allowing for a lot of bells and whistles. And I thought, by the way, also this discussion this morning about SMEs and how we can actually better relate to SMEs, which seems to be not just a challenge in the UK, you know, it's the same also in many continental European countries. It's, you know, the problem is not, you know, it's kind of like at one point I thought, you know, we're looking for the shepherd dog that actually then is chasing all the SME sheep into our courtyard. I think this is not the challenge. You know, our challenge is how we can actually become more attractive for these types of businesses if you think that is the future. And my personal view, by the way, is, you know, to talk about small businesses as SMEs, that's already the beginning of the problem. Because they very often call themselves family business owners. And that reflects a certain philosophy, how they actually approach their business. And I think what business schools preach very often in the classroom is not in line with how these types of businesses are run. And so I think it's about setting ourselves up intellectually so that we can be good connectors for the various people that we want to bring together, from science, from industry, and whatnot. And I think the big conclusion of all this is that business schools will succeed also in their current form, yeah, as a comprehensive provider, if they start to focus more on the intellectual production, on knowledge and learning processes, rather than on purely structural indicators, you know, starting, you know, with the ranking, managing the ranking position of a school.
I guess one other comment. I think you can create opportunities for that, those silos to be broken down, if you like, and we all operate, but certainly most universities operate in these big silos, and the business school faculty don't talk to the engineering school. Often they're geographically separate on campus and so on. A couple of things we've done is through having innovation competitions where the students are required to work together. So you have to have an innovation project, which typically often is a science or engineering type widget or piece of technology, and then they have to work with the business students. And so those competitions have brought them together. Sometimes many universities have their own commercialization capability, like we have at our university, a commercialization office. We don't call it that, but they will sometimes come and talk to us about new products coming out of, say, IT or out of engineering. They want a business capability joined to that as they seek to commercialize that product. But I think there are ways you can bridge it. Double degrees is another one that's emerging. Is if you're serious about your double degree, rather than just cobbling together a few science courses or a few engineering courses and a few business courses, but actually force or encourage, I should say, that's a better word, encourage the faculty to actually integrate the process, the students who come into that double degree program get the opportunity to learn from their business colleagues, and there is a possibility then of on-selling or of developing commercialization strategies around new product development. So there are ways of doing it, but you've got to create them, I think, because the natural tendency is for everybody to stay where they are, where they're comfortable, and not move out of that comfort zone.
Thank you. Kenneth Raja from the Royal Agricultural University School of Business and Entrepreneurship. I'm reminded by the saying that when Harvard and Hollywood come together, you get showbiz. However, my more serious question is there a relationship between brand, content, and fee structure? Is there any relationship? And what is it that is attractive to a potential student and to an employer? Thank you.
Yeah, I'll give that a stab. I'm not sure exactly how to approach answering a question like that, but I think the answer is yes, there's a relationship. And I think that's a relationship that tends to reinforce itself. So business schools today become organizations that help individuals invest in reputation, right? So there's brand that plays along with that, and that brand association for professors is one that works. So their work reinforces it, the brand reinforces their work, and that works. There's a fellow named Deepak Jain. Deepak Jain's in many ways an institution in our industry, and I remember a long time ago, he said a few things that stuck with me, but a long time ago, he did a presentation and he talked about the role of business schools in knowledge creation. And he talked about the role of business schools in knowledge dissemination. And all of this so far is familiar to you. But he said, you know, increasingly business schools have to think about knowledge monetization. And not just through degree programs. And the investment that business schools make in creating new ideas and in making those ideas relevant and useful to business, we need to begin to think about the revenue models associated with those. And I see quite a bit more of this happening today than ever before. So if we're talking about relevance and research relevance, one of the things that I see happening is there's a lot more emphasis today in creating tools that businesses can use. So if a faculty member's done some research on a measure, you know, whether that be a measure of cross-cultural engagement or something like that, something that could be relevant or useful in business, that business schools play a role in helping to commercialize that and indeed under the brand of the business school. So I think I went a bit further in addressing your question than you intended, but definitely, at least in terms of the research and the brand working together and complementing each other, I think that there's a big, big role for reputation. Now, how it relates to the fee structure and tuition and things like that is a more challenging question for me to answer. I think a study would probably indicate that the stronger the brand, the higher the price, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But some of that research may suffer from lack of knowledge about the amount of tuition discounting that's available in the investment of the school in building its brand. So That's about the best I could do for that question. I'm sorry.
Maybe in a year or two I could answer you when we are able to put up our fees in Australia. You know, see the answer there. But I think if you studied fee setting or tuition charge in the US, you would see a clear correlation between brand reputation and fees or tuition. I would imagine that being the case, Harvard you cited, or the Wharton School or Stanford, able to premium price their products compared to lesser known brands in the market. The UK experience is somewhat interesting when you were given the freedom to put up your fees to £9,000. I think pretty much everybody went up to the ceiling and there wasn't much differentiation and everybody kept their students, basically, maybe in a bit of a dip for a while. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that to be the case. That So most schools went up to, you know, the £9,000 and most schools kept their students, a bit of a dip, but they came back. Nods, is that the right?
Postgraduate, there's no ceiling.
No ceiling, yeah. So in postgraduate, London Business School may charge more than, and so I think you'd find that that hypothesis would hold out. I wouldn't like to comment on the content of the delivery or the programs, though, but certainly there seems to be a correlation between brand, reputation, and tuition, I would think.
Very clearly, you know, why would business schools actually invest in reputation if it wouldn't affect their resource base? I think the real question, however, is how does reputation management affect the surplus situation of business schools? I think that's the more interesting question because, you know, as you try to enhance the reputation, you also drive up your costs that are very often quasi-fixed and you buy into very volatile revenues That obviously then enhances the exposure to a margin squeeze, and that is the whole problem that that business schools are potentially facing down the road, that may threaten their financial viability.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you. That was very instructive. There's a little bit that I thought would be helpful to have your observations on, which is the relationship of the reputation, brand, and fees to content. So when a university, well, in American dollars, if it's $100,000 versus a school that charges $20,000, is the content that different in the United Kingdom here, where you have £60,000 and perhaps the very lowest in the last survey is something like £6,000 or £7,000? My question is, We have to come out of a marketing think on this one. Are we saying that there is that difference in value, or are we just saying, well, that's the power of branding? Thank you.
It may depend, if I can just take the Canadian example. Our fees are controlled. If you leave the MBA programs aside, because those programs, the fees vary greatly. In terms of the undergraduate program, there's not a lot of differentiation. It's pretty close. You know, it's not tenfold, and Canada is still quite, for lack of a better word, cheap in international standards. But in the case of Canada, I think students are coming for the Canadian brand in general, and certain cohorts of students, the really good students, are going after certain universities because they know they can get in. But in terms of Canada, because the national education brand is very strong, we don't have any trouble getting undergraduate students. We have trouble getting certain cohorts of undergraduate students. But in the case of Canada, it doesn't seem to be linked to the cost, except at the MBA level. That's a bit different, where people are clearly buying a name to put on their wall. Whether that's linked to the quality of education, that's a debate that perhaps is...
So we've actually done some research on some of these questions, and the answer depends on who you talk to in some ways, but... I think your question is, if you look at MBA programs, for example, is the content of those MBA programs the same or different, right? And I think generally what we're seeing is that they're becoming a bit more differentiated. But in the past, when we've done these studies, they are surprisingly homogeneous. So the sort of flip side of that is, for example, our colleague Patrick Cullen. How many of you know Patrick Cullen? He was a co-author on a book called Rethinking the MBA, and he works at AACSB, and we've continued to explore some of these questions. to some extent, it depends on how deep we're able to go into the curriculum, but also it depends on who's teaching. So, for example, even if a course might be called strategy, if you take that course at Harvard Business School, you know, for example, with Michael Porter, and you take that course at INSEAD, you might get really two very different perspectives on what matters in this emerging environment. So the answer to that question is not all that clear. But I used to always say, I still say it, that one of the things that makes every business school different is their faculties. And regardless of what the names of the courses are, the experience base, the engagement of the faculty in practice, not only their academic experience, can make the educational experience very different. And I think that's a pretty critical factor.
We have a last question here. I'll just want to comment, then I'll move to the next question. In the Canadian context, it could be that in certain cases, certain schools have higher admission levels. So some say they can get a different cohort of student, a bit better student, and some of the schools in Canada are a little bit better resourced. So the expectations are higher. I don't think the programs are very different, but there are some cases, especially the MBA level, where the expectations might be different. I think we have a question over here.
Ken Stalky, Nottingham University Business School. I think there's a number of dimensions to the debate that's going on, and I think Ulrich's point about institutional purpose is crucial. And I wonder if from your different parts of the world, you could reflect on that. It seems to me, I mean, I can imagine a world with much fewer business schools. You know, I think business schools are probably oversupplied. I think in Germany, as Ulrich said, they're not very strong. Someone said in Australia, 30% of degrees awarded are in business, which seems somewhat high. And in the UK, it's about 15%, I think. So there's a difference in how they perform in different contexts. But I think the dean of Haas, you know, so a top American school, has said by 2020, 50% of American schools will be out of business. Clayton Christensen saying 50% of universities, so that might be a bit over the top. But clearly, you know, there are lots of disruptive things going on. Now, it seems to me that the only way one can guard against that as an institution is to develop a sense of institutional purpose. And it does seem to me that around that, it's about justifying the business school as some sort of professional school. But I wonder what your thinking on that is and whether, from different parts of the globe, my guess is if you were three medical school deans, you'd actually have quite a lot of things in common. And kind of the answers you've given would be fairly unanimous. You'd have a relatively common sense of curriculum, you know, a common sense of what an undergraduate education in management would be. And it seems to me the problem with management actually is it's actually our research base and our theory base. We don't have a clear science of management yet. And I think the answers you gave around different students and how they respond figures that. So reflects that. And it seems to me that the only way forward is to move much more towards some kind of professional knowledge base underpinned by research and cohering around agreed codes of conduct. I'm not talking just ethics there, but around a way of dealing with the big business, societal, economic problems, and a way of configuring business schools around what you would expect in terms of the range of disciplines and how they came together to solve that. But I think, you know, we seem a long way from that situation, really. And I think the kind of things that are coming up in this conference are around expressions of difference, really, rather than, you know, common challenges, but a range of different answers.
I obviously fully agree with you, Ken. That's what I said at, you know, the beginning of my introductory remarks. We're very good at actually describing the problem. That is exactly the problem, that we seem to be more preoccupied with ourselves and organizing ourselves rather than creating clear benefits for our stakeholders. And corporates are undoubtedly very important stakeholders of business schools. And, you know, the ultimate challenge is, and I think there we need a much broader debate, how we actually, what catalysts do we need and we have to create to initiate lasting change? You know, there are various elements, and we couldn't probably discuss this for hours. But to what extent are we actually willing to, or to what extent are business schools and business school deans in a position to experiment, to try things out? You know, we know that in the UK, I think the average tenure of a dean is about 4 years. And so, you know, you may be out of a job very quickly if you're not performing well, if it's not showing up in the revenue figures and in the rankings. And so it's actually very easy to just, you know, if you want to be remain a dean, yeah, and don't want to, you know, risk professional death, that you just play the game. And I guess that is the problem. And to what extent, you know, then again, you know, there are obviously media companies publishing rankings that have a certain responsibility here. I think accreditation organizations have a certain responsibility to initiate this debate. Maybe to also entertain creative flexibility, how they look at business schools. And as I said, you know, maybe also recognize recognize performance in ways that we haven't recognized it so far. And, you know, you haven't mentioned that, but I know there is a discussion within AACSB to look at subcomponents of business school activities and maybe to allow for some more explicit recognition. I think this is a very interesting thought. Or, you know, when we talk about impact, you know, you may, you know, the way we actually define excellence is basic, is on in using very traditional, very conventional socioeconomic indicators. You know, basically how we generally seem to evaluate performance in our society. And so, you know, let's say take a business school that does not focus on top flight talent, does not want to educate the Goldman Sachs investment bankers, but really pulls people out of economic environments that are, you know, clearly disadvantaged, and consistently is able to pull these people up into and put them in a on an economic career path where they can be much more successful. I would call that this is real impact. Yeah? Do we have any measure in our system where we actually recognize this explicitly? Not so far. I think these are the kinds of debates that we need. I have in various contexts. So, for instance, we have initiated this EFMD Higher Education Research Conference to also foster research on business schools. And you know, we have been around the block with these issues there as well. So it occupies many different circles. But then when it comes to, well, now we all agree, you know, so what do we do to change it? That's when actually the discussion becomes very difficult, yeah? And then very often the session is over. And I think that's where we have to move forward.
Well, I think we have about 2 minutes left, so maybe I'll just leave a last couple comments. Go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
Yeah, I'll make this quick, I think. Some of this I'll try to touch on tomorrow, in fact, in the dialogue that we'll have around these questions about impact. But, here. Deepak Jain's going to love me, I tell you, because there's another one of the other things he said. He said this in Cartagena, in Colombia. I heard him say that business schools have been better at performance than at purpose, is what he said. And I think this is exactly what you're talking about. I'd like to quote somebody else, Paul Woodgates, earlier today. He said something like, we will move from public service to social businesses. And I think this is a little bit of a sense that we are developing in terms of the role that business schools play in our emerging environment. And I think you're right on with that, Ken. I think, Ulrich, to reinforce your points as well, that this is one of the big things that's emerging in our environment, and that is to begin positioning business schools as social enterprises in some way. So,
if I just may, as the only dean up here, speak from a perspective of the dean of a business school and reflecting on Ulrich's comment, I don't think there are many deans who are just interested in maintaining the status quo, but the institutional forces that or barriers to radical or substantive change are great. And they're not just your vice chancellor wanting you to turn in a budget number. They're also your staff. or your faculty who have got a huge investment in the status quo. And like I have a faculty of 250 or so. If I try and move them all to the flipped classroom, I'd have a revolt. There'd be the union would be on my back. There'd be a hell of a lot of problems. So the institutional barriers to change in large business schools are quite substantial. And it takes a lot of courage to be willing to take those on, and given the short tenure that might be the outcome, actually achieve the change before there's a new dean brought in. Now, I've managed to survive for two terms, and we've improved our school substantially, but we haven't made that radical jump. And I think that's the challenge that we're faced with now, and it's kind of the boiled frog syndrome. You can improve, but the water can still be boiling, and eventually incremental improvement mightn't be the answer.
Anyway, thank you very much. We tried to cover the entire planet, non-British world, in 1 hour and 15 minutes. I believe our contact information is probably in the kit, so if you have a particular interest in Australia, or European, or some other, or Canadian or other markets, please feel free to get a hold of us. I'm sure if I could speak for my colleagues, we'd be all willing to answer any questions or make any contacts you might have, be interested in, if those are markets that are particularly interested to you. Thank you very much.